Welcome to Charles Stanley Radio, podcasts providing economic updates combined with some light-hearted conversation during this time of uncertainty. We talk to people from across Charles Stanley to get their insights and recommendations for life in lockdown.
Good morning, everybody. My name's John Cunliffe. I'm the Chief Investment Officer of Charles Stanley, and my colleague John Redwood will introduce himself.
Yes, John Redwood here, the Chief Global Strategist.
Okay, and John and I were having quite an in-depth conversation this morning around this whole issue about what central banks are trying to achieve. And interestingly, overnight, the Bank of Japan decided to scrap the limits it had on its daily purchases, or rather annual purchases of Japanese government bonds. And the sense in the market is that this could be the start of a race to the bottom as far as currencies are concerned. What's your take on that, John?
Well, that's the danger, isn't it? I mean, the background is that the governments of the world have decided they have to close down large amounts of their economies to try and contain the spread of the pandemic, the coronavirus. As a result, we were facing an economic meltdown. So the central banks, quite rightly, have intervened and said, we will create a lot of money, pump a lot of liquidity into the system, make sure there is credit around so that businesses that can't trade can survive and that businesses that are trading in an impaired way have some money. And in the meantime, they will obviously help the governments of the world raise huge sums of money, because it's to the governments ultimately the bills are going to fall. If people are unemployed, they'll either be under a furlough scheme getting money from the state, or they'll be directly pensioners of the state on benefits, and there will also be a decline in tax revenues. What we're now seeing, as you rightly say, John, is an even more interesting development. That the Bank of Japan says it will create as much money as it takes, it will buy as much debt as it takes. There's no ceiling on it because they're so worried that the Japanese economy is going to fall too far too fast. On their official forecasts that they launched a few hours ago, they're talking about a 5% drop in output for the year as a whole, which is a very large drop. And that means a far, far bigger drop in the immediate quarter at the center of the crisis.
Yeah, there's a great comment. And I mean, do you think there's a risk in the current environment that central banks almost compete against each other to provide increasing levels of stimulus via quantitative easing in an attempt really to try and weaken currencies as well, that this actually becomes a race to the bottom and that the end result could be, on the part of some investors, some degree of loss of confidence in so-called fiat currency?
Well, let's hope it doesn't, but that is a danger. At the moment, the central banks will say to us, you have no reason to lose confidence in our currency. It's quite true that we, the Fed, are creating lots of dollars, that we, the Bank of Japan, are creating lots of yen, but there isn't going to be an inflation. The reason that central banks don't normally do this, they don't normally create lots of money and let the state spend it, is that if they did so, it would normally be very inflationary. But in a situation where lots of prices are falling, the oil price has collapsed, there's a lack of demand, meaning this huge downward pressure on prices, the central banks feel they have an awful lot of wriggle room, that they can get away with doing things that they wouldn't normally do. But there will be people in the markets who say, well, it's all right at the moment, there isn't going to be an inflation. But what might happen in a year or two's time if we're getting back to something nearer to normal and there's still all this money and liquidity sloshing around? Could we then get an inflation? And the central banks will need to craft their messages very carefully to reassure everybody that they're not going to move on to a high inflation strategy in due course.
And I think that's exactly the point, because in the near term, we're entering the sort of Fisher debt deflation style scenario, which is clearly a very bad one, when falling prices means the real debt burden on the part of corporates in particular, but also government is actually rising, and that's obviously a major issue in terms of debt sustainability from a corporate perspective. Obviously, central banks would be very happy to try and find a way of getting prices up whilst keeping bond yields down, because that means the real debt burden falls over time. But either scenario doesn't strike me as being a great one, because clearly falling prices is bad. You know, it does give rise to more embedded and entrenched retrenchment on the part of consumers and corporates. But obviously, rising prices is also bad if bond yields are very low, as central banks try and keep borrowing costs down. because obviously people can lose confidence in currencies. So it's a fine line to tread, isn't it, John?
Yes, it is. But I think I'm a little bit more optimistic than the drift of some of those comments. And I think one of the reasons is they're all doing it. This isn't one central bank trying it on or doing something aberrant. The Federal Reserve Board is creating huge quantities of dollars and buying up a lot of American debt, no longer just buying up treasury debt, state debt, but also buying up debt of companies. Bank of Japan, we began the conversation by saying, has announced no limits on the amount of debt it will buy up, the amount of money it will create. The Bank of England is undertaking a bond purchase program. The European Central Bank has announced a much enlarged bond buying program. So relatively, it's difficult to say one is worse or better than the other because they're all following a very similar policy. And so the acid test of the policy is, do inflation prices in the shops stay under control or not? And I think for the time being, they do. It's just very important that these special measures are withdrawn in good time as and when they work and as and when the economies start to return to something more like normal life.
I mean, I think that's right. I was partly playing devil's advocate, John, but I think that you've given me a very good response. I think also central banks would love to have higher inflation as a problem than lower inflation, because we know what persistently low prices has done in Japan since the 1990s. You know, it's been a huge constraint upon confidence of the consumer sector and also the the corporate sector as well. It's been eroded profitability in a consistent fashion as well. So certainly higher prices from current levels would be a welcome development once we get through this disinflationary pull.
Well, that's right. And as you always rightly tell, Charles Stanley, research people, inflation around 2% is probably a good thing, because if you have the Japanese experience for too long, where people expect prices to be lower next year than this, it takes away any incentive to go and buy something that you're not sure you need, because you think, well, if I delay it for a bit, it might be a little bit cheaper. Why don't I just see what happens? Whereas if you have a mild inflation, there's always that added argument you can put to yourself when you're hovering over whether to buy something or not. You can say, well, why don't I buy it today? Because they might put it up 2 or 3% before I get around to buying it. It can be helpful to consumption to have mild inflation. But if you allow inflation to go too high, as those of us of certain years remember from the last century, you do get into all kinds of other difficulties where companies find it difficult to finance themselves. And where you need preemptive price rises to try and maintain your margins and generate cash, because so many of the inputs you need are going up in price in a way which can be difficult to finance.
Yeah, that's great. And I think it's probably worth sort of looking ahead then, on the basis that at some point in the quarters ahead, we might return to something a bit more akin to what's a normal situation as far as the economy is concerned, possibly the financial markets as well. But do you think there'll be some lingering effects in terms of the behaviour of consumers and corporates, which will change the landscape, if you like, going forwards?
Oh, I think there will be. I mean, I think this is an enormous shock to the system, with really bad numbers for at least a quarter, and then some return to more normal levels of demand and income, but with also some damage. And I think the trends we saw before the pandemic arrived are going to be exaggerated and speeded up. So I think the trend to online shopping as opposed to shopping in a physical shop will continue. I think the trend to doing more of our communications by social media and now by radio and televisual conference calls, that will accelerate. I think businesses who will be trying to rebuild badly damaged profitability will want to take cost out, and they'll see the advantage of the digital revolution and online solutions. And I fear the customer will be, in some areas, a bit more reluctant for a bit longer. Having absorbed the health messages, people are not necessarily going to want to rush out into highly populated places for events. And so the prognosis for the tourist and entertainment industries is rather worse than the prognosis for the more essentials.
So really what we're talking about is a world where corporates are going to be trying to build increased resilience into their business models, because clearly this has been a huge shakeup for them. And this might have impact in terms of supply chains as well, and simplifying business models. But also it's a world where, you know, consumers themselves will have some lingering degree of caution, which in the round will also mean that consumer spending will tend to be a little bit more tepid, perhaps, and possibly the savings rate, if possible, might nudge up a little bit.
Well, I fear that's right, because I think some people will have lost their jobs. Some will keep their self-employment or their jobs going, but they'll not be earning so much money. Their turnover will be down or their bonuses will have been cancelled. And people will be a bit more apprehensive after a shock like this, thinking maybe I need a little bit more money by way of reserve in case the pandemic comes back again in a second wave, in case there needs to be reimposition of some of these very difficult controls. But I think it's a climate in which investors can still find opportunity. There are obviously quite a number of businesses in some sectors that are doing very well in current conditions. Those that make food products, that grow food, that are involved in food retail, those that are involved in other basics to keep our lives going, those that benefit from people staying at home and doing more things at home, and those that benefit from the digital revolution to come. I think they are all reasonable investment prospects.
That's exactly right. It's something we've been talking about for a while. I think in the current environment, clearly investors are very keen to get earnings visibility. They're very keen to invest in sectors which are not as cyclically exposed as clearly some of the ones that you highlight. And in this world, it's clearly, that the sectors such as tech, pharmaceuticals, consumer staples that have done very well. But companies in the round which have been paying arguably too high a dividend to their shareholders and are fairly leveraged and more exposed to the business cycle tend to be a bit more vulnerable. And we're seeing really quite a large bifurcation between so-called growth stocks, which tend to be more highly rated by the market, and so-called value stocks, which are more cyclically exposed but tend to be a bit cheaper. And I guess that's likely to stay, John. Is that right?
Well, that's right. I mean, you and your research team have been very good at working out which of the companies are likely to do better and are more solidly based. And inevitably, in a situation like this, where people are expecting most companies to report down profits and difficulties against this national and international background, there will be chief executives who were struggling a bit anyway on their business strategies who say, well, this is a good opportunity to make some provisions, report some extra losses and so forth, on top of the losses that they're genuinely incurring because of the business conditions. So I think we will see some of the overpayers, the companies that are struggling to maintain their dividends, use this opportunity to take the dividend down to a new base after having perhaps had a period of not paying it at all. And we will see some of those companies that are facing very rapid structural change in their industries making quicker adjustments than they otherwise would have done, both to their cost base and to their treatment of shareholders.
That's exactly right. And I think, we were talking a little while ago, John, about the sort of move towards less globalization. So whilst global trade was rising, it was rising at a slower rate relative to global growth. And that was really in evidence post 2008-9. Clearly, the trade war that we saw in sort of 2018 and part of 19 sent that a little bit further into reverse. But we're now entering a world where, as we look into the future, the type of business model that people are going to be adopting could well be one that favours a more local supply chain, maybe a bigger national champion, one that's a bit more robust in terms of its business model. It's possibly a world also where we could see maybe slightly lower margins in some sectors, but maybe higher in others, as we see a number of winners from this, where we get a move towards a slightly more oligopolistic type of environment. Have you got any more thoughts on that, John?
Well, no, that's exactly right, isn't it, that we see these trends developing. The Trump-China trade war looked like a bit of a one-off before the virus hit, but that is now spreading to other countries in a slightly less dramatic form. A number of countries are saying to themselves, I'm spending a lot of state money on pharmaceuticals, in due course on vaccines and other medical requirements and protective clothing. Maybe I need to source more of that at home because I've discovered there are interruptions to supply when going gets really rough, as it has done in recent weeks. You've then got motor manufacturers or other people assembling complex products saying to themselves, do I really need to have a global supply chain over the whole face of the globe with many countries and many risks. Why don't I get more of the crucial components I need sourced locally under supervised contracts? You're going to get governments wanting greater local content at a time when there's more unemployment and they need to show they're doing something to help local workforces. So yes, there are plenty of reasons why people will want to cut the risk and the spread of their supply chains and why they will want to see more work and more activity taking place closer to home.
Yeah, I think that's a great comment. I agree with all of that. And in terms of the pattern of global economic activity that we sort of kicked off by talking about, I mean, we all agree, I think, that Q2 will be by far and away the worst quarter that we've seen since World War II. You know, what do you think the general pattern of growth will be like over the balance of the year, John?
Well, I'm hoping before the year is out, we start to see decent rates of recovery from the very low figures we're going to experience in the second quarter. But we're not going to get back to anything like the level we were at in January, February of this year for some little while, because we're going to see a fairly gradual relaxation of controls. Let's hope we avoid the need to clamp down for a second time, that the governments judge it correctly and that the health services can cope. But it's going to be a fairly slow recovery back to the starting levels, although the percentage gains in the early stages will look very good, because if a whole load of companies weren't able to trade at all and then suddenly can sell something, you get quite good looking figures. But you've got to remember, it's on such a dreadful base. And I think an impaired performance from the world economy and the big national economies for the next year or two. And if you look at the underlying growth rate, factoring out the bad couple of quarters in the middle, it's going to be very sluggish.
Yeah, and I think as we know, revenues are aligned to global growth, particularly nominal GDP, and obviously corporate profits are leveraged off that. So when you get such a big collapse in activity, such as we're in the throes of seeing, corporate profits amplify that move, and obviously we get quite a substantial decline. So my sense, John, I don't know what yours is, but my sense is that we could easily see global corporate profits fall by maybe more than 50% before recovering, and maybe at the end of 2021 staying at the level they were at the end of last year. Is that a reasonable sort of expectation to have, do you think?
I fear that is a reasonable expectation, and I think it's a worrying thing for markets. Now, let's cheer people up. Within that, there will be some sectors and companies that do extremely well, and their share prices will perform extremely well on the back of it. But quite a lot of the companies are going to report dire profits and no dividends, have not fallen as much as you might expect, thanks to this wall of liquidity, this huge amount of money being pushed into the market by central banks to buy up all the bonds, which then spills over to shares, because the people selling the bonds to the banks probably end up keeping money in or adding money to their share positions. And so you're getting a position where quite a bit of the market is getting progressively more overvalued. And I think this is one of the worries I have, that even the shares that have fallen a bit so far this year may be dearer now than they were at the start of the year, because their earnings have probably fallen away much more quickly than their share price. Now, the liquidity will take care of some of it, but it clearly won't take care of those that go bust or go through financial reconstruction. So it's very important that share pickers, or the pickers of the right markets and the right passives, don't have too much exposure or any exposure to those areas of the market that are going to go through painful financial reconstruction. I mean, you might think, for example, of the airline industry, where I suspect quite a lot of equity has been wiped out in an industry that was very competitive with very low margins. And we're probably going to see quite a lot of financial reconstructions to the detriment of existing shareholders.
Yes, and I think your comments about a tug of war, if you like, between liquidity and also actually low bond yields, which do tend to inflate present values because of the discount rate you apply to future earnings, being a tailwind on the one hand and obviously a headwind on the other, is the valuation that you talk about. It's also noteworthy that you know, we were talking about this earlier, that the correlation between individual stocks in each of the major markets has been very high. So it does suggest that in the very near term, markets have been maybe not quite as discriminating as perhaps they should have been between some of the issues that John's already highlighted. So going forward, we think there will be huge opportunities for clients to align their portfolios to those sectors most likely to benefit from the general trends that John identified at the start of this call. So I think that's been a very good conversation, John. Anything you'd like to wrap up with at the end of this call? Because I'm mindful we've taken up enough of our listeners' time.
Well, just to confirm that I think you shouldn't give up on investment. These are difficult times, and there is more work to be done by the markets on deciding which companies are going to shine through and are the future. And there will be quite a few that have the right models and the right opportunity to grasp, and those that are in the sectors and the areas which are really very badly damaged by this, and that may not today be fully reflected in the
prices. Yeah, that's exactly right. I think for the time being, markets perhaps haven't been quite discriminating enough, which we think gives our managers huge opportunity, I think, to add value at portfolio level. So I think we'll end it there. Thank you very much indeed for listening, and we'll be in touch again soon.
Thank you for listening to Charles Stanley Radio. I hope you enjoyed this episode and that it offered a small escape from life under lockdown. Please subscribe to be kept up to date with our latest releases. If you have any questions or comments about the content covered in today's episode, or any questions you'd like us to address in future episodes, then please do email these to events@charles-stanley.co.uk. Once again, thank you for listening, and as always, stay safe. The value of investments can fall as well as rise. Investors may get back less than invested. Past performance is not a reliable guide to the future.